This is Fresh Air. My guest today, poet and novelist Jim Harrison, worked as a hod carrier who occupied his thoughts with poetry and paced his work by playing in his mind the music of Stravinsky. He now makes enough money from screenplays to write his novels and poems without having to carry bricks. Because of his outdoor themes and active male characters, some compare him to Hemingway, but Harrison says Faulkner is a literary mentor for the depth of character he likes to develop. His writing has garnered acclaim and admirers, many of whom are men attracted to his themes and rugged characters. My guest travels widely but prefers to live in Upper Michigan, where the hunting and fishing are good, and it takes a while to find him. He was in New York the other day to talk about his new book, a collection of three novellas, each distinctly different in style and character. One of them ran recently in The New Yorker, The Woman Lit by Fireflies. I asked Jim Harrison to read from the opening.
She had not yet accepted as real the quiver in her stomach and the slight green dot of pain in the middle of her head that signaled an incipient migraine. Her husband on the car seat beside her punched in a tape called Tracking the Blues, which contained no black music, but rather the witless drone of a weekly financial lecture sent from New York City. This particular tape was 7 days stale and had been played 3 times on their trip, but Donald repeated it to get fair value for his money. The tape not incidentally replaced Stravinsky's Histoire du Soldat from an Iowa City FM station, a piece she always enjoyed. Do you mind, darling? He asked. Not at all, dear, she replied, partly because the pain clinic she had attended in Arizona that spring had emphasized giving up resistance to outside phenomena at the possible onset of a migraine under the notion you wanted to starve rather than feed the affliction.
Have you suffered migraines yourself?
No, I haven't, but at this clinic, sort of spa clinic in Mexico, I ran into a lot of somewhat middle-aged ladies that had, and I seemed to always been interested as an artist in the subject of pain, and I had one aunt with severe or terminal migraines, so I became interested in the perceptual distortions that take place, too, just before a migraine, you know, which are similar to those that precede grand mal seizures and epilepsy.
The story is told from a woman's point of view, which is a point of view you took in your novel, Dalva. How did you shift your sense of perspective to capture a sense of woman in pain?
Well, I think it started, perhaps 10 years ago. It's that Buddhist notion, really, is to study the self is to forget the self. And if you can manage to forget yourself, then you can be anyone, you know. And so when her voice arrived, that's usually, it's as if someone were talking to you. When her voice arrived, I was receptive, you know, and slipped into that voice.
This is Claire's voice.
Yes.
How did Claire's voice arrive for you?
Well, one night I was thinking of, again, those ladies at the spa, and I was out in the barnyard of my farm, and it was a particularly strange summer night, and the swamp and the marsh near the barnyard was almost dense with fireflies, you know. So that's when I thought of a woman, you know, who's left her husband at a rest stop, you know, on the highway and just climbed over the fence and ran off in a cornfield. So somehow that whole beginning came to me right at that point.
I like the idea of the woman crossing the cornfield. It was very much almost like a pilgrimage across a desert that she was making.
Yeah, that is, it's almost ritualized, you know, building her little shelter there by a river, falling in and consequently feeling baptized by it, and then cleansed later, you know, when she washes by the irrigation pipe, that kind of thing. Because, of course, if you're going to make that violent change in life, the more ritualized you make it, the more permanent it would be.
Have you used ritual to change your life?
Well, somewhat, yes, of course. You know, I have to. I found out at this advanced age, when am I, 52, that I'm a great deal more fragile than I thought. So I do spend a lot of time by myself in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, walking, you know. I think I took 50 or 60 walks this summer, and I never saw another human being. So that's part of the ritual, you know.
You're in New York as we're talking. What kind of journey would you take to get home? How would you go?
Fly to Detroit or Chicago, then fly up to near Traverse City. And that's where my farm is, and then my cabin's way up in the Upper Peninsula. So I'm just, my farm is about 300 miles north of Detroit. And then the place in the Upper Peninsula is another 200 miles further north.
So it takes a long time to get there.
Oh, yeah.
It's.
But then I got to see, last 2 years ago, I saw a timber wolf on the log road near my cabin, so you don't get to see that here, so it's worth the trip.
I live in California and in San Francisco, and Terry, who normally does the show, lives here in Philadelphia. We're on the coast, and you've described these coasts as dream coasts that are not conscious of the geography of the interior. What are we missing by not being in Michigan?
Well, I'm not so sure you're missing anything. It's a predilection, you know. When I was 19, I had to live in both New York City and San Francisco. I mean, I had to see them. In fact, I hitchhiked all the way to California to see the Pacific Ocean, just out of curiosity. But that's sort of one of those goofy things a Midwestern farm kid does, you know, out of Sherwood Anderson. I want to see the ocean, so I saved up $40 and off I went. I wasn't disappointed at all.
Many of your readers over the years, through your novels, including Wolf, A False Memoir, and Sundog, have been a male. There's an attraction, there's a gutsiness of your writing that seems to attract male readers. And sometimes reviewers have commented on your macho life or your macho mm-hmm. writing. What do you think reviewers mean by this? And do you consider yourself macho or whatever that might mean?
Well, no. I mean, it's oddly enough, that's what I meant by the remoteness. I'm not so sure we're the United States of America in that sense, because I grew up, it's just the way I grew up, fishing and hunting and in the woods. And that's just what one did. It's the same as kids grow up playing stickball in New York. So it just reflected my background. You know, we're a child of the culture from which we emerge. And I mean, still one of the other novellas in here called Brown Dog is very much reflects that. That background. I just didn't want to feel limited by a voice, and I think part of the whole macho thing was partly from the feminist movement, people very sensitive about the issue. But I, having spent a great deal of time in Mexico, I think a macho is someone that throws a rattler in a baby carriage or something like that. You know, it's gratuitous cruelty is what macho is. And I certainly am a kind old soul myself, as it were.
There's an author's note in Sundog where you say, I must, describing the character you're writing about, I must content myself with having known a man completely free of the bondage of the appropriate. Could you elaborate on the idea of the bondage of the appropriate?
Well, it's the idea, you know, I remembered Walt Whitman's introduction to Leaves of Grass, you know, where the sense of, in other cultures too, the free man is the man who has absolutely no habits, you know, of any sort. You know, like they say in Zen, if you want a drink, have a drink. you know, but make sure that's what you want, that kind of thing. But the appropriate in every sense, to be free of all constraints of any sort. But the way you free yourself from all constraints is by the extremist form of discipline, you know.
You seem drawn to ideas of Zen philosophy. Have you spent time sitting Zazen?
Well, yeah, but mostly on my own because I'm not around in the vicinity of any Roshi, though I did study with Koben Shino Sensei, who is down in Palo Alto for a while and is now in New Mexico. In fact, a Zen friend or priest gave me a quote to take on this book tour. You'd like, listen to this one.
Okay.
Regard this juggling, this so-called universe, as a picture show. Thus be happy. That's pretty strong, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it keeps you light, as it were.
So you were able to distance yourself then and enjoy the entertainment of this parade?
Yeah, I don't think it's even distance yourself because you have to be totally present if you're going to do this. It's mm-hmm. pain. It's more, people should know, it's more painful to distance yourself, you know. I mean, just be where you are with all your heart and mind, and sooner or later you'll find yourself someplace else.
One of your poems, First Day of Painting, every other line refers to one of the subjects you want to paint as a nude woman, nude women.
Mm-hmm.
What is erotic for you about writing?
Well, I don't know. I've been accused of this. This is true, too, that sometimes there's a tendency while you're writing that when you're what they call horny, you write a sex scene, and when you're hungry, you have a food scene, you know. And I like to write about, it's an intoxication with the ordinary in life. I think writers get lost by being very brilliant about perimeters and being very brilliant about edges, and then they forget the core, you know. Hmm. And food and sex are, shall we say, at the core, you know.
What is the importance of garlic in your life?
I couldn't live without it, frankly. I get a lot of mail from young writers, and I always advise them. And I'm very hesitant to give advice because I reflected that five or six, maybe even seven of the people I had given advice to had committed suicide, you know, during my lifetime. So now I just tell young writers, don't forget red wine and garlic.
And has the survival rate of people you've given advice to increased?
No one who's followed that dictum has committed suicide. It's a guarantee.
How did you first discover the powers of garlic?
Well, it's from growing up in a Swedish farm family in northern Michigan where there was no garlic, and I came to New York City to be a beatnik and to imitate. I wanted to be like Modigliani, you know, the crazy painter, un vibre of mes ententes, you know, that kind of thing. So my first week in what I call Greenwich Village, I discovered this garlic, and I thought, my God. Now I treat it as a vegetable. You've been in Mustards, have you? Up in Napa Valley?
I've been past it. No,
yeah,
I've been...
you know, Cindy Paulson roasts whole heads of garlic basted with olive oil and thyme, you know, or rosemary, fresh rosemary. And then you eat the garlic cloves. They're softened and roasted. You eat them with an oyster fork and spread them on toast.
It's the latest drug of choice, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm glad I was in there early. I still try to collect a lot of California wines, too.
Is your wine cellar the result of affluence or the result of gifts?
Well, no. I called it the Warner Brothers Memorial Wine Cellar for a while. Because I was 39, I think, before I made what they call real money. 12 years ago, and I tended to fall into the trap that successful boxers do, you know. I squandered it all, but I did manage to build up a really considerable wine cellar.
When you're writing a book, do you take pages of it and read them aloud to your wife?
No, not that, though she reads. She and my oldest daughter, who is perhaps my best editor, read them first, in manuscript, to see if I haven't done something totally ill-advised.
And do you take their advice?
Yeah, frequently. My daughter teased me and Dalva about pulling back from certain sex scenes, so I amplified them.
Well, that's an interesting relationship you have with your daughter.
Yeah, well, she was teasing. Well, she's 29. She's been around, as it were. And she just did notice that I get a little squeamish at times, or feel that I can't handle it.
You lost your left eye in a childhood accident, and there was a nice way of that you described it in one of your poems. Your left eye is blind and jogs like a milky sparrow in its socket.
Yeah. That's an odd image, isn't it?
A milky sparrow. Have you seen a milky sparrow?
Well, it's just the idea, a little wobbly little bird in my head. I like to say I can see ladies in the full moon with my blind eye, which of course isn't quite true, Jogs,
Did you replace it with an artificial eye, or do you keep a patch?
No. That was the horror of the experience. They thought they were going to pull it out. It's still in, but... When I was 7 in this hospital, a salesman of eyes came by, and I got to see all the possibilities. He had a big case full of about 500 glass eyes,
This must have been really startling as a 7-year-old.
Yes, it sort of stuck with me for a while. Now, the worst thing about the experience is where we lived, there were no diesel trains, and at night I would hear this diesel train, that horn, and I didn't know what it was. So I naturally assumed it was dragons, moaning out there in the dark. So I suppose that was constituted a trauma, the experience.
Well, I've liked sitting down and talking with you today on Fresh Air.
I enjoy it.
Writer Jim Harrison, whose books include The Volume of Poetry, The Theory and Practice of Rivers, and a new collection of novellas, The Woman Lit by Fireflies.